I had the need to find my own real home, and that was nature. And so, yeah, now I have my own garden, and I planted more than 150,000 plants just to study the plants, and that is really where I could disappear. I really need that as something to live, the urge to be surrounded by green.
Was mit Kunst? Ein Podcast von und mit Johann König.
Today's guest is Arne Quinze. This is a re-air for a conversation we had a while ago, but we re-aired because of the opening at König Bergson, so the König Gallery in Munich, opening on June 12th. You're very welcome. In the silos, which are in the former coal oven of the Bergson Kunstkraftwerk. Anyway, listen to Arne Quinze about his practice now in the podcast.
I think I didn't have really the choice. I think I'm born with this urge in my veins to create. And I remember the day that my parents divorced, when we moved to Brussels in that very gray area, very mineral, because I grew up at the countryside, surrounded by flowers and wild bees and butterflies and birds. And then to have that shock in the 80s, to have that limitation, the borders of these walls all over, I miss the colors, I miss that vibrant life of nature. And then there was a time that I started to spray the trains and the walls to get my colors back around me. That is how it started.
And so where did you grow up?
So I born in Ghent, and I grew up in more at the countryside, at the coast, and then in Brussels. Mm-hmm. Then we moved to Brussels.
So then there was like a city, suburban.
Yeah, Brussels was at the countryside, was literally countryside. It was mm-hmm. like the garden went over into the fields, and I had, as a small kid, I had a feeling that the garden was still till the horizon.
Like endless, yeah.
Endless, mm-hmm, endless. Mm-hmm. And for me, it was like every day was like a big adventure. It was like already there, I was building my little camps, my little installations with everything what I could find. So for
what
me...
What did your parents do?
So my father actually was at that time already like a very active climate activist in the 60s, in the 70s. And he was a sculptor at the same time, and his mother, his grandmother, was actually a painter. Mm-hmm.
So there was an artist running in the family.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Absolutely, yeah. But for me, my biggest teacher was nature. Mm-hmm. That was my endless inspiration. I was always diving in my own little microcosmos world, and that was the place where I felt really home.
Mm-hmm. And then in moving from the countryside to Brussels, then you started to do graffiti and things like this.
Yeah, because I really missed that, my friends, the butterflies and the flowers and nature in general. Because when you grow up as a kid with no limits or in that absolutely freedom, and when you see everything in balance around you, and then you move really from one day to another day, to Brussels, and in Brussels in the 80s, it was quite rough. It mm-hmm. was really, it was more like a dirty city, mm-hmm. and really gray. And yeah, that was the day that I say, yeah, no, I need to do something. And mm-hmm. and I remember spraying a train, so it was an opening of the metro, subway station, and I think I was 15 or 16 years old. I entered up I went down into the tunnels with a backpack full of spray cans, and I sprayed literally that brand new gray train from the beginning till the end. And then at the morning was the opening of that train station. So you see everybody well dressed, the mayor was there to cut the ribbon, and you see that train coming in that brand new train station, but fully sprayed. And I was in the middle of that crowd, still with my hands full of paints, hiding in my pockets. But what I saw, the reaction of the people when that train came in, so the half of the people were say, wow, they thought it was part of the opening. But the other half say, wow, that's big vandalism. That is what happened here. But what I really liked is that the people that liked the train and the people that didn't like the train were all talking to each other. It was like that very specific, great energy. And I saw that this connection and say, this is one what I want to do in my life, is to reconnect these people through art, through my installations or through my paintings.
And you were doing this as an individual, or you're doing this in a group?
Like the I built up my own graffiti gang. Mm-hmm. And I think they're still active today. That's why I cannot mention the name. They're very active. It's already, I think, the third or the fourth generation. But I started first as alone and then very fast after a year.
In a collective.
I had my gang, yeah.
Yeah. And how did it continue then? How did you, like, when did the world of fine art sort of...
So I went to some academies, art academies, but I didn't finish them because I was not always agreed with the teachers. I mm-hmm. had to find my own way. And I remember that my first exhibition, I think I was maybe 20 years, and I didn't want to hang up my paintings like on a normal way on the walls. I wanted to do something like already interactive. And I built that kind of wooden construction to hang my paintings in. And so it started to work on my large scale installations. And for me, the most important thing with this public installation is going back when I moved to Brussels. Everything was hidden behind this walls. This confrontation of these four walls had a big impact, because when we are born, the first contact that we have is these four white sterile walls of a hospital. Now we go to school, then we are encountered by these four walls and brick. Then we go to the office, it's the four walls in concrete, and we die. They put us under the four walls, under the ground. And it's the same for art. Art is also most of the time hidden behind the four walls of a museum, especially in the 80s of the 90s. It was not so easy to just enter a museum. There was always like these big stairs, these big doors. It was almost pushing more the people out and pulling the people in. And so for me to share my art was important. And that's why I started to create these public installations to bring people back together and to share. Mm-hmm. So from that on,
you grew from sort of graffiti in the public to working on canvas? And then again into more construction installations?
Or? Yeah, it went all a little bit, I would say, together. Because painting on trains is a kind of canvas. But there I learned how to handle the scale, the big scale. And that is what helped me to build this big installations in public site. Also as a child, playing in nature, you had the difference between like a little tiny little flower and the tree. So I was used to have all this diversity of dimensions and structures. So for me, painting on a train was thinking more in a three-dimensional way. So for me to have the step from painting to my sculptures, it was natural. Yeah.
So how, when you say you did installations in the public space, this also you did sort of uninvited. You just had the idea and then you start to build, or you ask for permission, and describe how can we imagine them? How did they look?
Going from the very illegal graffiti art on in public spaces, my first installations were also more guerrilla. And from that on, slowly it started to be more and more like legal space. Mm-hmm, because mm-hmm. at a certain scale, you cannot do this illegal anymore. You need to have the permits and yeah, it's money involved, and you need to have sponsors and step by step. But also there in the beginning, it was always, I remember like the first one almost 30 years ago, when you received, I would say, €1,000 and your installation costed €3,000. So you made the debt of €2,000, so you had to work again to fill up that gap. So in the beginning, it was always almost surviving, but it was a big fight to have this kind of installations in the world. And the debts that we made were starting to be bigger and bigger and bigger, because in the end it was like really massive installations. But in a certain way, at a certain time, we we managed to make that circle round and to be able to live from that. And then you start to build a studio, and the studio is growing. Yeah, it was a long way, but mm-hmm. it's
after. But take us to your first sort of public intervention, which was not two-dimensional graffiti on the surface, but an sculptural construction. Like, how did it come to you? What material did you use? What was the shape of it?
In the beginning, were the wooden installations. It's very organic wooden installation because it was a material that was for me easy to have. It was at that time for me the only ones that I could afford.
Mm-hmm.
And that is how I started to build up this installation.
And where it was in Brussels? Or
Brussels, yeah.
Yeah. So and then you took like sort of favela style thrown away wood and whatever everything I could find.
And then slowly when these pieces start really to be like legal and big, we start to buy wood that was special planted to be cut.
So, but at the beginning, you just assembled stuff and...
Stuff, everything what I could find.
And then, so what's a graffiti on an electro box it's, then was like a shuffled together stuff in the public space?
It's for me, everything what I could find, I used. Every kind of material, but mainly based on more on wood. Mm-hmm. Because I always like to work with like... more natural materials. Mm-hmm. For me, natural material is or wood or iron or aluminium or glass or clay. That is for me the more natural.
And how important was like the circular reuse of materials? Was it a concept or was it just a pure necessity because that was the only material you could afford to work with?
In the beginning, was just the only material that I could afford. But at a certain point, we started to build these big, massive installations all over the planet. And then we really worked with wood that was planted to be cut. And every time we redonated the money to replant the amount of trees that were cut. And next to that is that all the wood that we used was always 100% recycled to make wooden panels or books or mm-hmm. whatever. Yeah.
And can you describe the early installations? Like what was the shape? Did it have a figurative shape? Was it abstract?
It was 100% abstract because I left very fast the figurative shape because also in the 80s to make some money, I was painting a lot of billboards for movie theaters. Mm-hmm. So I needed really to be precise. And I painted a lot of trompe-l'œil. I don't mm-hmm. know the right word in English. But it needs to be so right, so identical. And at a certain moment, I felt so claustrophobic because for me, what I was interested in was in nature. And my bottom heart, I'm more a gardener. That is a place where I belong. And for me, it's the power into that fragility or the fragility and that power that I see in nature that I was... what I want to express.
So, but were you then sort of building flowers based on thrown away material? Or was
no, more really organic shapes.
Okay.
Really mm-hmm. organic because when as a child, when I built my little model maquette cities in the garden, my own little micro universe, that was the place where I was dreaming when I could dive into that universe. And that is also what I tried to do at with my bigger installations. And still today, my work is for a big part abstract because it's up to the viewer to dive in and to have his own journey on in my work to mm-hmm. dream about their own what they see.
But these construction had no function. They were not like a shed, like a homeless shelter or something.
No, absolutely no function.
They were not to enter. Yeah.
No, there's no function at all.
And you said that you were painting movie posters. Were you trained as a painter, or is it all self-taught?
I think it's self-taught. I'm born like this. Since a very small... I think my first sculptures that I still have, I was 3 years old. And never did something else.
And when you... So how long was the duration of that sort of public interventions? One day, 1 week, until when did the city municipality come and take it apart, throw it away?
Oh, yeah. It's some of them were sending them for quite long. And they rot away. Mm-hmm. And some of them were taken down in the day itself. It was the same with the graffitis. Some graffiti stayed there for months and months and months, or sometimes for years, because I painted on so many difficult places that other people were difficult to reach or to clean. And some of them were raised, gone in a day.
And when you did these sculptural interventions, did you communicate that they are from you? Because, I mean, it's also like at the end you get liable. And when did it start that other people invited you to create this on purpose? Because like how to get a name, I would say. And then also at the same time, when did you understand that this is can play a role within the art market, that people are exhibitions, invite you, collectors buy stuff like this? Like, when did that occur as a possibility?
I remember my first exhibition. It was a printer that printing company, the owner was, he loved art and he was really into that new young generation he was following, and he saw what I was doing, and sometimes I was telling my stories to him and I was sharing things, and that was one of the first people that say, you know, I want to do something with you. And then it went from one step to another, and I think it went slowly for me. It went slowly for other people. They think it went very fast, but it took years to build up the name. And in a certain moment, you come from the illegal world, you go to a legal world, and yeah, it's. But for me, it went all like in a smooth, organic way. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's just by the people you met and the chances that you create or that you receive. But it was always like it's a big challenge of surviving.
And when did it start that you understood that you can make a living off?
I always knew that.
Oh yeah.
Always intuitionally. It's always knew that from a young zone. I was say, this is my goal. This is my life, and I always knew that.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And now I don't know how many years later you created a garden, like literally your own garden, which is sort of the I don't know font of inspiration. Maybe you can explain us a little bit what you did there.
So the garden came as something that I really, really needed, because for many, many years I was traveling all over the planet and studying cities, and I made a lot of work around that, is that how people are behaving on this planet. And I saw that wherever in the world, whatever kind of city, the people live in exactly the same way. You have all these big apartment blocks and they put so many people as they can in these blocks. And if you take the signs away, you will not know if there's an apartment block from China or from New York or
around here the
or
church.
Around here also, the church. Mm-hmm. And how more I was diving into that, if I could say, human world, is that how more I had the urge to go back to the countryside. And then I found I could buy a house in Belgium, because I lived in Miami, and then I had my studio in Shanghai, so quite big metropoles, and I had the need to find my own real home, and that was nature. And so yeah, now I have my own garden, and I planted more than 150,000 plants just to study the plants, and that is really where I could disappear. I really need that as something to live, the urge to be surrounded by green.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So, but the path you took was assembling all that stuff, creating sort of these public intervention, and then it picked up, and then you were invited to places to create structures on purpose. And then you also had sort of an excursion into a design practice. You also created furniture and stuff.
No, it's what happened is that in the path that I made, at a certain moment I had a big studio, and it was like more a collective from all kind of creative people, and it was like architect, it was design, and it was so many things in. But for me, in the base, I was really an artist in the sense that I could not make something that was really made to to be used or a real design. I was actually not really good in that. And at a certain moment, I split it up, that whole studio. So the designers went one part, the architects went another part, and I kept just my atelier, what I was working on my sculptures.
Sort of purposeless.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and that was for me really important because for me, I want to have that absolutely 100% freedom to create and not to have this limitation. So these walls, I am quite allergic to that. And mm-hmm. it's very duality because I live also in a house with four walls. So that is my constantly fight that I have. So I love intervent in cities. I can survive in cities for a couple of weeks and then I need to run out and I need to go. I need to find my air back into nature mm-hmm, and to mm-hmm. see my friends, the trees, the plants, the butterflies. Mm-hmm, yeah, mm-hmm. It's.
But interesting. So you created these sculptures also not like as a shelter, but somehow as a contradiction to, because I mean, architecture houses are sort of orchestrating how we live together on an extreme efficient way. And these abstract sculptures were somehow as a utopian or a counterposition.
Yeah, it's also because when moving to Brussels when I was 9 years old, I saw that the way how people lived in cities were very quite social. Everything went so fast. Everyone was moving fast. There was not really a social contact. And I grew up in the streets. So I was like, very bizarre. I miss that. And I always believe that the day that we will build cities with the same harmony or the same diversity as nature, that day we will have human cities. And the public area is so important. We saw that during COVID. We were all forced to stay between these four walls. We were ready to get mad. And the public space is so, so, so important. And I think how more we invest in public spaces, how more our life will be better. Because kids, when they grow up in cities, they don't know what are frogs, they don't know what are butterflies, they don't know even what are seasons. It's very difficult to be in contact with the four seasons when you live in a city. So I think public spaces are so important, and I think we need really to invest that. And it's not only to take the cars or out of the cities, but it's to give something back to nature, but also to ourselves. And I think the day that we will create that balance to create that diversity again in cities will bring us back, and will give us a better life. I'm sure of that.
And to explore the work you're doing today, you create a sort of abstracted flower-esque sculptures in the public space, which are made of aluminium. Yeah. And where's the aluminium coming from? Like, how do you find that shape? Maybe you can take us on the process.
So the process to make these aluminium sculptures or the installations I do in steel and aluminium, first it starts from my garden, mm-hmm. diving into my garden, looking at all what I see, to dive in that, this beauty, the diversity, and that so with that inspiration, I start to draw and to make the models. And these models, I made them always in paper. So and what inspires me a lot in nature is that monono aware is the beauty in decay. And when I take my paper, I like to, yeah, how to squeeze my paper models to try to find that force into that fragility or the fragility into that force. And when my paper models are done, then it's my team is coming in. They scan the model and then they start to work or with the engineers. And always the engineers come to me and they say, Arne, this is not possible. And then I take the engineers to my garden and say, look, it is possible. We need to find a solution. And then it's after this long conversations and many, many different calculations and to find the solutions, we come then to the technical drawings. The technical drawings, we take them to our studios and then we start to rebuild exactly these shapes in aluminium. So we always start from plate, aluminium plates, then we laser cut them, then we roll them or we weld them in a certain shape. Then I take them to the where I squeeze them with my, they have like a big massive crane. I call them like the T-Rex. And the crane man is following my hands exactly the way how I folded my models. He's folding my big aluminium pieces in the same way. So that force into that fragility, what I see in nature, I transfer that to my installation. And that is what I want to capture. So and these elements, I bring them back to the atelier and then we start to weld.
And the large sculpture is a one-to-one sort of enlarged reproduction of your paper model, or is it?
It's very, very, very similar.
Similar. And
very
inspiration
similar.
Comes in from the botanic...
For my garden.
Mm-hmm.
And especially for... Yeah, when I always say that beauty in decay, I always invite people to really come to my garden, and then we sit on our knees and we dive into that, because we have always like a different view on nature. We always try to control nature from above. But for the moment that you sit on your knees and you dive into the world, it's like a beautiful microcosmos.
Mm-hmm.
It's like an avatar in your own garden.
Aluminium is a pretty ecological material because it
needs
a lot of water to
it's
to
I know I'm not here as a climate activist. I try through my work first that the works are durable.
Mm-hmm. So it lasts
for me it's important that we can recycle it, and in the same time is that aluminium for me, or steel, is what is for me the work, the material that can represent the best my work from a model to a real size.
Mm-hmm.
I know it's we all have a big footprint on the planet, and I think it's also what we give back, and then next to that we try to give everything back what we can, and that's why we have also the project in Brazil that I planned with Go Forest. It's a company that we plant, I think, around 60,000 trees almost every 2 weeks.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So
mm-hmm.
it's always we try to live in
balance.
In balance. And
yeah.
And I think as an artist we don't need to play the holy
I mean, the big difference now, as you say, it's durable because these work they stay, right?
Before they say
the interventions were
the interventions they stay forever, and also I was trying to find a material that were the maintenance was so less as possible. The other thing is that many times where we come into with our installations, we see that the whole surrounding is changing, because in the same time we fight to change the whole environment more in these big gardens. Yeah, the duality in my work is that I know we work with aluminium and steel, but in the same time my work is to show the beauty of nature.
But it's a bit like an impressionist approach.
I'm really inspired by the impressionists a lot.
Yeah.
Also in my paintings, in my work, and the big difference is that the impressionists, when they went outside to try to catch that light that and to paint really what they saw, I paint with my gut feelings. When I come out of my garden with tons of pictures and films, when I start to paint in my atelier, it's really from my gut feelings, and I dive really into my own world.
Yeah, but tell me when you compare your steel or aluminium sculptures in reference to where it comes from. You earlier mentioned that the material you found and you assembled, that it also was just rotting away. You know, that so it's not durable. You use sort of recycled material, but how was it to find that compromise between creating the shape, but then at the same time making a contribution, because you work a lot in public spaces and in cities, spaces and so on, sort of bringing literally like flower to the concrete urban environment? And was it difficult to make that process from the found material, this ephemeral temporary interventions, to make that jump and twist into the permanent construction?
It happened because every time when we wanted to build like this big wooden installations, we had a lot of work to go through, permits, finding money, because these installations, I had all the work of the engineers, the approvals, etc., etc.
And fire department is a topic
and
too.
Fire department. Yeah. Because some installations were maybe 20 meters long, some of them were 80 or 100 meters long, 20 meters, 30 meters high. They were quite big.
Yeah.
And in the beginning, in many places where people were always fighting against us. To have, there was always people that were not happy because we changed their very safe environment where they live because people are so afraid of changements. And sometimes we had petitions or manifestations even against us. But when they saw when the sculpture was done, when they saw what was happening to the neighborhood, the same people that were had the petitions or the manifestations against us, they did it to keep the installation because they knew that also after 5 years we had to break it down because mm-hmm. we could not maintain the safety of that. And so in the end we had a lot of people ask, but why we cannot keep this installation because we were so happy in that neighborhood. I think the most beautiful compliment I ever received was a woman. I think she was 75 years old and she wrote me a handwritten letter, what is very rare in these times, and to say, Arne, thank you, because now I'm talking again to my neighbors that these installations bring really people together, the public installations. And that was the reason I didn't want to be an artist that always created the emptiness, because mm-hmm. the emptiness afterwards when we dismantled these installations was much bigger than the emptiness before, mm-hmm, because mm-hmm. they were confronted by this emptiness that we created. That was the reason that we started to create that permanent installation.
And you still do installations of wood? Or you moved away from that completely?
No, I moved completely away. It's, okay. It's 15 years ago, that okay. was the last one. Mm-hmm. And it was also fine. It's at a certain moment, I think as an artist it's fine to move on and to go to the next step. And I think and with wood I did everything what I could do. And
tell me, how did you, because I think the surface you're creating is pretty unique. So you have these aluminium sheets welded together in analog to your paper models you created. But how do you treat the surface that it has this effect?
Already I have all the scratches there and from my crane. So I'm trying to find this natural process when you see this beauty and decay in nature. And I try always to make my sculptures like they are not made by me, but by nature. And I was trying to find a process to a kind of anodize this line, the stripes of this erosion into the aluminium. And after we have a process that we put like a kind of transparent varnish over that. And that is really that the light, when the light goes through the varnish, hits the aluminium and come back. And that is what it creates, all these different shades of colors.
So, but the scratches and so on, they're intentional? And then
everything is intentional. So, but it's a process intentional, and it's also a process that we can manage for, let's say, for a certain percentage. We know what we are doing. We know what would be the outcome. But we work also for part with on our instinct. It's like when you paint a canvas, you know in the direction you go. But it's nice to in through your journey that you have a kind of certain freedom. To have this kind of experiment.
And then, but there's a certain palette you're using, right? There are like five different color tones. You oxidize aluminium.
Yeah, and I think it's the how deeper I go in that process, how more we learn that this monochrome works are today what I think the best for the sculptures, for the big, the massive installations. There we play with much more colors because these installations are so big that there is a need for more color. Mm-hmm, that's mm-hmm. A different approach.
And now you're currently working on a big project in Venice, parallel to the Venice Biennale, where you explore more material. I think for the first time now. Now you work with clay, ceramic, glass.
Yeah, it was a dream since long time is to experiment this materials. Glass, we do it with Adriano from Berengo Studio. And for me, it was such a nice thing to work with these glass masters and to have that interaction with them. Because the first ideas that I had, they say, no, it's not possible. And they say, yes, it's possible. And going through that process to find my own way, my own language. I think this is, as an artist, it's the most difficult thing, is to find your own language. And you find this by failure and by trying things out, and step by step you build up. So now we will have the glass sculptures, and then the ceramic was the same. The size that I want to create in ceramic, it was almost impossible. It was quite difficult. So I had to find like ovens that they could, and also a company that had the knowledge to work on that scale. And I was happy. I found a company in Belgium. They have amazing, great ovens, the Atelier Vierkant, and together also with their knowledge, I was able to work on the ceramic sculptures. And we will show a bronze sculpture too. It's also my bronze sculptures, I made them exactly the same way as my aluminium sculptures. So it's really like this, one-off organic sculptures. And then,
so the bronze is also a reproduction of the paper.
Exactly
but how, Ben? You don't have the sheets, you need a mold, no, of
making no we work with bronze sheets.
You take bronze sheets. Before they melt it, so to speak.
We have these big bronze sheets, and then we work in the same way as aluminium.
So you don't cast the bronze.
You take the raw
bronze sheets.
Yeah, and then we work on that
and
directly.
And then you weld them together.
Yeah, we weld them together and we scratch them. And it's quite difficult because bronze is so much harder than aluminium. It's mm-hmm. It's complete different way how to squeeze them. And that was quite difficult. And then we have the sonic levitation installation. And that's an installation that I make with Swiss beads. And why? Because in the beginning, I referred to the impressionist. And when you go outside of your atelier and when you stand in the middle of your garden or nature, there is the impressionist. They always try to capture that light. So for me, light was a very important one, because a year ago, I did that installation for the Noor Festival in Riyadh. And that was one of my first outdoor installations with light, because outside, light is so important, and I tried to do something with the light. And another thing was the sound, because I had the sound of the birds. I want to implement the sound, and that is how this installation start to grow. So now in Venice, I'm working with Swiss that is making that sonic installation that will come out of my installation, my aluminium installation, and we work with the light in the same thing. So it will be
an immersive installation.
It will be more like how I feel of what I see when I'm in my garden, and that beauty I want to bring over to the people. It's the beauty of the magic, what is happening in the garden. People forgot what it is, but the magic is really happening there. We all have avatar in our garden. You just need to see it and don't be afraid of that beauty. And I think my work is more a window to my garden, my inner self, how I see the world.
And the glass objects, how to imagine them? You also, I mean, is there like how's the pre material looking before it's sort of blown into glass?
So for the glass project, it started from a metaphor. Imagine that the world was in a perfect balance, perfect harmony, paradise. And then we had the impact of the meteorites, and the meteorites brought two things with them. It was the DNA of humans, that's why I called slash humans slash aliens, and the other meteorite brought the DNA of the religion of the four walls, what I explained before. Mm-hmm. So if you look at a science fiction movie, the first thing what the aliens are doing is trying to conquer the planet. But we as humans, we do exactly the same. That's this wall that we want to build everywhere, try to limit ourselves. So The exhibition starts with that meteorite in glass that we casted. And out of that meteorite, there is life coming out. And it's all abstract. And it's
so it's a certain narrative you explore there.
Yeah, it's like the alien is coming out of that meteorite. But the alien, we are the aliens.
Because we as humans fight our planet and destroy it.
And that is also the name of the exhibition. Are we the aliens? And it's just for me, it's like holding a mirror in front of everybody, because we hear that already a million times, climate change and that we are abusing the planet. But if we try to understand that we are the aliens, maybe we will look differently to our planet and how we behave. And that is, I want that the people leave that exhibition with a question mark. Say, yes, wow, are we now the aliens or not?
But you include literal meteorites? No.
Because we did a study about meteorites, how they look, how they feel. So I found one of a collector that has maybe one of the biggest collections of meteorites in on this planet, and now we are looking maybe to bring some real meteorites there in, mm-hmm. or we will show them in a movie, because we are working on a movie, like an artificial movie, because that is the only, if I could say, different race than us, because on this planet there's only one race is living, is we humans, the mm-hmm, aliens, mm-hmm. And I think there's a second race is growing up, is actually artificial intelligence, and we are making a movie with this pure on artificial intelligence, and for me these are the aliens on this planet next to us, and I'm very curious how it will move further on, how this development of artificial intelligence will be in our life.
So, and the artificial intelligence movie is based on your sort of pre-prompted narrative of the meteorites.
Yeah, it all starts from the meteorite. It all starts. I'm questioning, what are we doing here? What are we really, the aliens? Why are we building these walls? And I'm also confronted with this limitation, because I don't live naked somewhere in a grot in nature. I also need these walls. So I'm questioning myself, why do I need this? Why I need that protection as a human?
And do you, it sounds like that in this project you also try to include others on a collaborative base to give a bit away of the creative process? When you work with a glass executor and Vierkant and Swiss Beats, like to, and AI to...
This also there, it's I need both. I need, as an artist, I need to be alone in front of my canvas and to be confronted only with my canvas and myself. And on the other hand, I love to work with a team. I love to work with people, and I love to exchange all these kind of ideas and try to get to find kind of solution. And I really need that. I really need to work mm-hmm, with both. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Maybe last, you mentioned your canvas again. You also would show a big painting in Venice, and the space is a convent, right? An active.
Yeah, it's quite a large space, and so you have the Scoletta, you have an old monastery, you have a beautiful cathedral. So in the cathedral you will see the bronze installation. In the monastery you will have the ceramics. But the ceramics are quite big. It's going from 2 to 4 or 5 meters high. And then in the Scoletta, you enter to the meteorites, the glass installation. You go up. You see that installation that I built with Swiss. And when you turn around, when you leave the space, you see my garden. And that's a window to my garden. And what is flying above my garden is that meteorite will fly above my garden. Mm-hmm. So the paintings are for me, yeah, those are really the windows to...
Okay, so the paintings are a representation of your garden, and the garden is a both imaginary and...
Yeah, absolutely. My garden is quite...
Like Garden Eden in all our gardens somehow.
All our gardens, but my gardens are always painted quite abstract. Because I don't want to paint like really like a flower, how a flower is. But that is not. It's not interesting for me. I really like to find the edge on that power and to that fragility or that mono no aware, that beauty in that decay. That is what I try to capture, like and the light and for me when I paint I hear the sound. For me it's music too.
But as you say you do not with an image in front of your gun, it's more of intuitively.
Absolutely. You know when I paint I have all kind of images around me that I took from my garden, but I have also pictures.
But it's not nature, right? Because I mean the difference, I think a lot of people mistake sort of outside as nature, because nature, real nature, is very rare. Because when we have I think we have a forest here in Berlin, which is actually a real nature,
no,
but most...
There is not any landscape in the world that is not infected by humans or aliens, not any.
It's because it's not all any. Sort of human...
Everything is human transformed, if I can say. For me, it's really my...
If you think even the rainforest? There's not even...
Especially the rainforest, because they really discovered that the rainforest before, there were quite big, massive cities from the Incas and the Mayas. And a lot of earth on that forest is brought in from cultivated, because the earth is so black. It's
exactly,
not really from,
yeah,
it's not from there.
Yeah,
and they're discovering that. Even all over the planet, you can go in any islands far, far, far away, you will find traces of people or even a plastic bag or whatever. So we intervene in everything. So for me, when I paint, I always say my garden is that nature, is that... My garden is quite pretty wild, because when I plant the flowers, I plant 150,000 plants, and every year we plant more and more and more, and some plants are disappearing, and some plants, I never cut in them, I let them grow. It's even my house is disappearing 100% under the plants. In the summer, even the windows, you don't see the windows anymore, the plants are growing over, and it's just, in the autumn, we start to cut open the windows, because then we need again the light, because in the summer it's like a natural barrier, and it smells so good because it's full of flowers, and that is what I like to try to do, is to be able to live in harmony with the surroundings, and yeah, that's where I feel home.
Mm-hmm. But interesting, there's no more nature, like pure nature.
Pure nature, I think, almost not. It's difficult to find pure nature, because we intervene in so many places, or it's a road, or it's...
How was the desert for you? Because you went to the Nur, that was in the desert, right?
Yeah, that's in the desert.
I mean, it's like the contradiction to a garden.
It's a contradiction. In the end, it's the same. It's this so powerful landscape. It's so large. It's so... it's also so expressive. When you're there, you feel the desert. It's you're so small,
mm-hmm.
and I think when I sit on my knees in the garden, when I lay down, I feel also very, very small, because I have the plants are much taller than me, and the trees, and I have the same feeling in the desert. So I am a child of nature. I think it's this where I function the best. In any place on the planet, for the moment, is in nature. But I need the green. For me, the desert is fine to cross the desert, or to build the desert into. But in the end, I need to have my trees back.
And when you mentioned the painting, there's a garden and the Metroid sort of arriving, yeah.
To mm-hmm. see what and for me that Metroid is a metaphor. I know that we didn't come by Metroids, but it's just to try to explain that. Imagine we are the aliens. You have a complete different perception on what we are doing and how we are behaving. I think that's the most simple idea to try to explain to people. If you explain to people all the negative effects about climate change and how we are consuming the planet, it doesn't have an impact anymore. We hear that already 1,000 times.
Mm-hmm.
If you tell the people, like, you are the aliens, see how we behave, I think you have a completely different perspective what we are doing. Mm. And that is what I try to do.
Also in the sense of foreigner, sort of.
In all kind of directions.
Yeah.
And it's, for me, it's quite boring. There is just one race on this planet. And for me, it would be a dream to have really aliens here, like in Star Wars, or that would be really fun. That could be very interesting. But there's just one risk: it's humans, and we're all the same.
Yeah. Great. Sounds interesting. Looking forward to see it in Venice.
Yeah,
Arne, thank
welcome.
You so much taking us onto the journey.
Yeah, thank you, Johann.
Was mit Kunst? Ein Podcast von und mit Johann König.